Thank you, Leo. So it's always a great pleasure to come to Santa Barbara. Gerard, if you fell asleep, I wouldn't take this as an insult because I understood you just took an international travel.
You will wake me up.
I will wake you up.
Great physics.
Sounds good. That's a pleasure. So I will tell you about optical lattice clocks, where some surprising recent work about spin orbital coupling has come out of this clock directly. But I've been doing optical lattice clock with eye towards studying many-body quantum physics anyways. So it was interesting to be able to actually engineer spin orbital coupling now into many-body interacting system with fermions. And that's really sort of a very exciting new direction for us. On one hand, studying clocks. On the other hand, using that to study novel quantum phenomena. And in some sense, that falls into the scientific vision we have had for many years, for 15 or so years, to really think about what is the best atomic clock that you can build. And I think especially now, thinking about using optical lattices where you have many, many thousands in the future, I would love to have 1 million atoms confining as a band insulator in an optical lattice, where the clock precision can reach on the order of 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 21. And you can have a clock sitting in the middle of the universe and see all the gravitational waves and so on. How do we be able to really take advantage of atoms that has very long quantum coherence on the order of hundreds of seconds, and in millions of atoms all work together at the level of 10 to minus 20, 10 to minus 21, sort of a measurement precision? Certainly, the quantum many-body effects will play a role. If we do not understand it, it's going to be a systematic effect in the clock that we build. On the other hand, understanding it itself is intellectually very exciting. In fact, that's what the people are building their new experiments, specifically with quantum gas, to understand these quantum many-body physics. So to me, this seems to be a very good paradigm where the clock research now sits on both pushing the frontiers of metrology and measurement science, but also relying on the fact of understanding quantum many-body physics will be a key part of developing clocks. And in some sense, also provides a very clean system to study many-body system, because the clock precision and the control is unprecedented. In the end, I ask myself and many people in the community, is there really a limit in terms of how good you can make a clock? I think there is not. In fact, every time that people say there's a limit for how well you can make a clock, it always turns into a new opportunity to discover new physics. Because what is limiting the clock? It's going to be the space-time fabric that's going to limit the clock. And those are the new opportunities for fundamental physics. So on one hand, AMO physics, it's a very unique branch of physics, relies on ultra-precise measurements, ultra-fast science, ultra-cold theory. This is a theory that's actually done by Chris Green. It is a very unique combination of different sub-branches of physics come together to form AMO physics. But the AMO science, as exemplified by clock research, actually connects to condensed matter, high energy, and astrophysics, and so on. Because of the fact that as we push the precision frontier forward, it will allow us to explore new physics beyond the current understandings and the frameworks, and that connects out to high energy physics, the particle physics, and so on. But it's the study of many-body quantum systems connects to condensed matter. So that's the sort of the vision. And then let me tell you what particular atom that we use for clock research. It's sitting in the second column of the periodic table. The atom that of my favorite choice is the strontium atoms. And this is the atom that's studied by folks in Java, actually, for many years in the 1980s and 90s, Chris Green being one of them, studied, provided a lot of a theoretical underpinning of understanding the atomic physics structure of the strontium. And I just want to mention one particular property that's important for the spin orbital coupling that I'm going to speak about today, which is actually very long-lived clock states. The clock states are, for example, electronic orbitals that is shown by this Bohr's model of atom. And what we are studying is basically the electronic transitions between the ground state and an excited electronic state. Strontium has a property of one of its electronically excited state has extremely long lifetime. Therefore, if you pair a coherent superposition between the ground and electronic states, that quantum coherence stays for a very long time, 160 seconds, oscillating at a speed of just a few femtoseconds. So if I make an analogy to a pendulum, this is an electron cloud oscillating around the nucleus. And if I slow down by 15 orders of magnitude to a point where it's oscillating like a pendulum, one cycle per second. The fact that this quality factor of this electronic oscillation is so good, meaning that once you set this pendulum in motion, once per second, it will oscillate through the entire age of the universe. So that's the quality factor we're talking about, 10 to the 17. And if you want to build a clock, wouldn't that be great to have a pendulum which once you set it, and the gods put a spring on, and it's been oscillating ever since? You know, that's the kind of the pendulum we want to build atomic clock. And of course, I'm exaggerating. I mean, really, the oscillation lasts about 160 seconds or so. And just because the fact it's oscillating so fast, the number of cycles it went through is 10 to the 17 cycles. And so we use this atom to build a clock. And this gives us all the spectroscopy resolution later on will be very good for sort of controlling spin orbital coupling in our optical lattice. I want to give you just one or two slides about control of light, which is absolutely essential for building clocks, but also for doing the work that I'm going to talk about, spin orbital coupling. And that's because that pendulum has such a good quantity factor. You better have a field that can take advantage of this quantum coherence that atom has for you. So our atom actually oscillates, the clock transition oscillates at the red color, about 700 nanometers. This is the electromagnetic spectrum. If you zoom in by a factor of a million or so, you will reach a diode laser that we actually use to control the clock. And this is zooming in from this visible spectrum down by about a factor of a million. And you reach a laser diode that you use to listen to CD and watch DVDs. And this has a quantity factor of about 10 to the 6 or so. The line width is on the order of a gigahertz. If you zoom in another factor of a million, this is done by pioneered by work like Jan Hall, Ted Hinch, and so on, some of the laser pioneers. They were able to make very precise interferometers. In fact, some of the work that people pioneered back in the 80s and 90s laid the foundation for LIGO, for the recent discovery of gravitational waves. It really is because of the very precise optical interferometry. In this particular realization by Jan Hall in the 1980s, he was able to make a very precise optical interferometer with two mirrors attached to a very low expansion glass material, such that he can make a laser. He could make a laser at the time with a line width on the order of a kilohertz or so.
Is that a diode laser still or not?
That could be a diode laser, could be a at the time it was a dye laser. This was Shalow and Hinch were in Stanford were very active making stable dye lasers, and Jan Hall and so on, and Jella. And these, you can think of zooming another factor of a million from a gigahertz, also line width, down to about a kilohertz. And that's clearly still not quite enough. And we have yet to zoom in another factor of a million. Now we have zoomed in three factor of a million. So that's 10 to the 18 right here. And finally, we can reach a laser line width on the order of millihertz to 10 millihertz or so. These are the lasers that we can use to mate with, to match with the optical quantum coherence these atoms that can have. And so if you zoom back, you can have a laser with a line width on the order of a bit millihertz controlling the entire electromagnetic spectrum through the tools that Jan Hall and Ted Hinch also invented, a so-called optical frequency comb. So with a 1 millihertz laser, you can spread out this incredible phase coherence from one stable laser to the entire electromagnetic spectrum. And suddenly, all of the visible part of the landscape can have such a phase coherence on the order of a few tens of seconds. And I have one of the tools we use to realize optical clocks or spin orbital coupling here. And I want to just give you a quick example how we measure those coherence. And as people play music, knows that the so-called tune forks, that you can put two of them together and you can hear the beat of the sound wave. Sometimes of those high-quality music forks can have the sound wave last for minutes. And in fact, that indicating a quality factor of on the order of a million or so. That's considered very, very good to invoke. And we can borrow the idea of the beat into the optical domain if you have lasers, which is very coherent. It can bring them together and also hear the beat. For example, by bringing the two waves onto a photodetector, if the color of the lasers are close enough, the electronics can detect the beat signals. And here shows a beat signal between two independent lasers with a line width on the order of about 12 millihertz or so, which indicates each laser is contributing a line width on the order of 9 millihertz with optical phase coherence time longer than 20 seconds. It's not quite at the level of 160 seconds, I promised you, that those atoms are coherently oscillating back and forth. In fact, to be honest, when we put atoms in our optical lattice, they do not live 160 seconds yet. They live about 2 minutes. But you can see we are working towards there. And that's the goal that I have, is to be able to reach the coherence of 100 seconds and beyond with the millions of atoms together. Then that's a clock that will be three orders of magnitude better than the current very fast clock that we have in the lab. So in some sense, the clock research has tremendous of a potential in the next 10 years. And it all started by having this very basic idea. We get atoms cold, and because atoms are going to have long coherence time, we've got to be able to hold on to them to look at these atoms. So we have to cool these atoms to very, very low temperatures because of Doppler effects and so on. It cannot play a role. But then you have to hold atoms somehow. And we use so-called optical tweezers where we shine a focused laser beam into the vacuum chamber and we hold these atoms in the middle of the focus. However, we're also going to do spectroscopy on these atoms. The very act of holding these atoms by the laser tweezer, meaning that you're actually modifying the energy level structure of the atom. Otherwise, you're creating a spatially inhomogeneous electric field. That's why you can hold on to these atoms. That's where the charge is coming from. So how do we compromise between being able to hold on to these atoms for us to look at it for a long, long period of time? On the other hand, the very act of holding onto these atoms could introduce uncertainties, errors into your measurement. And the idea is basically building an optical trap where the polarizability of the two clock states are exactly matched, such that even though the energy states of these atoms are deformed inside of these so-called optical traps, but the differential energy between the two clock states, in fact, remains intact. And that is a compromise. In fact, it's a very, very excellent compromise that we now have, that we can, as I said, we can hold on to these atoms for a few minutes, a couple of minutes in those traps, and then maintain optical coherence. So we haven't demonstrated yet with a laser, but we are moving towards there. I will have a slide to show you the very latest work of creating 3D band insulator clocks with fermions and showing the longest coherence time we have demonstrated in so far. So the idea of this clock so far has been in sort of a one-dimensional system where it's just a single laser beam retroreflected to form a scanning wave. And you can think of the stack of pancakes with topping spread out in these pancakes. Typically, we have about 10 atoms per pancake. We have about 100 or so pancakes, so you can imagine that you have about 1,000 atoms in your clock. Each one of them is like a pendulum, so if you can make a measurement 1,000 times at a time, you improve your measurement precision by a factor of square root of 1,000. No wonder that I would love to have more atoms here. I would love to have millions of atoms, or even billions of atoms. The precision will continue to improve as long as I can control atomic interactions. And that, in fact, is the topic of today's talk, the atomic interactions that's going to be there. Precision metrology in optical lattice is actually a pretty good deal. Because we were able to hold these atoms very tight along this one-dimensional axis, it's called the z-axis, and we probed atoms, the clock transition right along this axis, this is so-called Lamb-Dickey regime, where the confinement, where the axial trapping frequency, the atom is being confined extremely tightly along this axis. And in fact, it's so tight, there's no photon momentum recoil kick when the atoms are being excited from the ground state to the excited state. So these are the ground, the excited electronic internal states. These are the emotional states, which are quantized due to the fact that these atoms are extremely cold. and being confined in that harmonic potential. And when we drive them, we can drive the sort of carry transition where the emotional side bands are not being excited or de-excited. And you can, as I mentioned earlier, because of you use many, many arms, you can include the precision by square root of that number of particles you use. And in spectroscopy system like this, there's no Doppler effect, there's no recoil effect. Yes, Leo?
Sorry, what? These oscillator states, these are the transverse or the longitudinal?
Those are longitudinal modes. There will be transverse modes if you don't quantize along this direction, yes.
So longitudinal ones, so, but it's a periodic potential, so within each well.
That's correct, yeah. So these are within each well. It's not a, I haven't shown the band structure, which was going to come later. Over the last few years, we have actually improved the spectroscopy quality factor quite a bit. Starting from back in 2005 or so, we were able to first achieve Hertz level spectroscopy resolution. To later on, by improving this, 8 years later, improve this by a factor of five. And in fact, we were by improving this by a factor of five, we were able to improve the clock performance by a factor of 10. And now, the latest result this year, we were able to now improve this by another factor of five. So it's getting close, it's not quite yet at the level of 0.001 hertz. We're still a factor of 80 away from it, but we're making pretty steady progress towards that direction. Associated with that high resolution clock spectroscopy, we can now build two such clocks and make a direct comparison. You basically build two, you know, if you have two clocks, and if you claim your clocks the best of the world, you cannot compare with other clocks. And so if you have to build multiple clocks and you compare them against each other. And this shows how well the stability of the clock actually holds up with averaging time, shows that if you, for example, if you average about 1,000 seconds, 15 minutes or so, you reach a level of clock precision of 10 minus 17. Corresponds to gravitational redshift of 10 centimeters on the surface of the Earth. And we can actually make the clock enough to the 10 minus 18 level. This compares to the current definition of SI second. This is held by the cesium fountain clock. And you can see that the latest optical clock can be a factor of 100 better in terms of the precision and accuracy. And indeed, this is a sort of a chart, historical chart of World War II when the atomic clock is being developed. This is the cesium clock records that's been held until very recently that's been crossed by optical clocks. And optical clock now has the lowest uncertainties and also the best stability, reaching a few plus 10 to the minus 18. But as I said, this is really only at the very beginning. I feel that the revolution of the clock will continue and go down another 3 decades in the next 10 years, or maybe it'll go down in 10 years. I just feel very exciting because, you know, pushing the quantum technology in our laboratory can have a major impact for other branches of physics because of the measurement precision. Eventually, it will allow you to measure some very fundamental physics that's being sensed by the clock, like such as dark matter and so on. But the today's story is really one I want to turn the attention now to the atomic interactions and tell you about spin orbital coupling. So, at the beginning, when we decided to use strontium atoms, I told you about this fantastic property of very long coherence time. But there's another story behind it. These atoms are, at least the atoms we use for our clocks, are the fermions. The strontium atom has a nuclear spin of 9.5. Those fermions, if you lower the temperature to extremely cold, extremely low temperatures, Professor Debbie Jin showed a long time ago, 15 years ago, that she showed the P wave can be frozen out. So that inspired us to think about fermions at ultra-low temperatures is a good choice for making a clock. And that's because of this poly-exclusion principle or anti-symmetrization principle of the two-particle wave functions. You have to have this negative sign when you, with respect to exchange of the two particles' position. And that means the S wave is not allowed. So when or other way of saying these two atoms cannot approach each other too closely to cause collisional frequency shift. So we can freeze out all these frequency shifts induced by the atomic collisions in the clock. And that was a big deal. So if we want to take advantage of being able to employ thousands to millions of atoms to gain the so-called signal strength or the stability without compromising its accuracy. This seems like a good choice to make. And indeed, the first measurements we made back in 2007 at 20 minus 15 clock accuracy, we show zero frequency shift due to the fermions. And if you use the bosons, this frequency shift due to the collision mode effect would have shown up a long time ago. So this, we felt this was an indication of using fermions as a good choice to make a clock. But as we zoomed into the precision later on, by another decade, we found out, in fact, the P-wave collisions does play a role. These atoms, even though they cannot have S-wave, they cannot have a square head-on collisions, they can basically have one H-by union of angular momentum rotating around each other, and then once you give them enough time, they are going to cause irritations on the other partners, and eventually there will be a frequency shift. And so that's what we measured. And later on, with the help of theory, Anna Maria Ray's theory guidance, we were able to paint a fairly clear picture of what's going on in these individual pancakes. And once you understood where these frequency shifts is coming from, we can actually control this down to below 10 minus 19. The most recent work, those so-called contact interaction shifts can now be moved down to 10 minus 24. So essentially, out of the picture for clocks for the next 10, 20 something years. In fact, what's more interesting will be dipolar physics in clocks, but I'm not talking about that today.
But these atoms are undergoing transition, electronic transition?
They're undergoing electronic transition.
They're not necessarily in the same state? They're colliding?
Well, if they're going, they're being excited together. So that's the point I'm going to come to talk about. If they're being excited together, you can think of, they're just making unitary rotation on the SO2 sphere. So they are always the same particles.
It's always identical.
Yeah, so they're always identical, unless your excitation is inhomogeneous, which can introduce S-wave component, or unless you introduce spin orbital coupling, and so on.
But isn't it, one can absorb a photon and the other one does not? Why does it have to be?
One absorbs a photon. What do you mean? So atoms
start. Why all fermion atoms have to transition at the same time?
Why do they all have to
absorb a photon?
They absorb a photon at the same time?
Yeah.
In some sense, there's no one particular atom that say, I'm going to absorb a photon, the rest of you don't. So you cannot really, if you say, I've got this 1,000 atoms sitting in the laboratory and I'm going to shine a CW laser onto it, and you can measure what's the fraction of atoms they have all absorbed the photons in a single photon limit. And in fact, 99.9% of atoms, in fact, do go this Rabi oscillation. I don't know if that's good, what you're asking or...
No, that is what I'm asking.
It's a single photon process because each atom has a one photon allowed transition, this clock transition. So each one of them can undergo this clock during Rabi oscillation.
I didn't get this numbers actually. Do you cancel the shift, the P wave shift, or you just understand what it is?
Yeah, you can cancel the shift. The data on, I will explain that to you. We can actually operate at a particular location by tilting the angle. Maybe Leo, maybe I go on to a few more slides so this will become clear. Also, in terms of how we control it, it will become clear. So, let me just give you a quick introduction of degrees of freedom in strontium. And it turns out, let's talk about 3 degrees of freedom. There's electronic degrees of freedom that I'm going to call the spin, pseudo spin half, bound, excited state, those 2 electronic states. But the strontium 87, the fermionic isotope, also has 9 half spin, nuclear spins. So if you apply a magnetic field, there's actually 10 components coming out. Notably, there's I.J term is actually 0 because electronic angular momentum is 0. Right, so whether it's triple P0 or single S0, J equals to 0. So I dot J equals to 0. But there's actually differentials, Landau G factors, coming from the fact that triple P0 state is not as clean as single S0 state. Triple P0 state, in fact, mixed with other P states, like single P1, triple P1. So there's a little bit of a contamination in this electronic wave function that actually allowed this transition to be taken place at a 160 second lifetime of the triple P0.
For bosonic isotope, if you don't have nuclear spins at all, this lifetime of 220 would live for 1,000 years or so, according to theory calculation. We were actually able to measure those differential energy factors to confirm the lifetime of 220 to be 160 seconds. And the 30 degrees freedom is, of course, special degrees of freedom. Those atoms are confined in the optical lattices, and you can use indices of N and M to indicate the harmonic levels, and you can have spatially symmetric wave functions or spatially anti-symmetrized wave functions. When you write down the wave function of two particles, in the end, it has to be anti-symmetrized, but it can come from any one of those electronic, nuclear, or spatial degrees of freedom, or all three of them, to make the odd. So that means if you had prepared atoms to be in a nuclear spin symmetric state, or you simply just nuclear spin polarize it into a single nuclear spin state, then for the two atoms to interact with each other, if you prepare them in all into the ground state, or into the excited state, or into the so-called triplet coherence composition, they would have to interact through the so-called P wave, where this special part of wave function is anti-symmetrized, because both the nuclear and electronic degrees of freedom have been symmetrized. And if you, on the other hand, prepare a nuclear anti-symmetrized wave function, then for symmetrized electronic states, you can still have S-wave interaction. This is very clear. This is just how do you play the symmetrization in those different electronic degrees different degrees of freedom of these two atoms. But what is interesting here is that nuclear degrees of freedom, we just said, there's no hyperfine coupling. But quantum statistics, you can control the nuclear degrees of freedom to use that to control how these two atoms come together, interact with each other electronically. And this is actually fundamentally important in some of the physics that we will talk about later. So the first experiment I want to show you, this interaction effect that's manifested in the clock, is a nuclear spin polarized case. So we're talking about this particular case. The nuclear spin is symmetric, or all the atoms are occupying the same nuclear spin state. Now what you have is just electronic spin degrees of freedom. And when you apply laser, all of these atoms undergo coherent spin rotation. This is perhaps was Leo's question. How do you know every atom is going through that kind of a Rabi oscillation? I guess we give them a sufficient amount of each atom. It's not a...
It's plenty of photon.
It's plenty of photon. It's not like one atom is absorbing photon such that there's no photon left. All atoms are getting starved. So these atoms are rotating up. There's also interactions. If there was... the clock is nothing but measuring the precession rate with respect to the field they apply. But if there's no interactions, then each atom can be viewed as completely independent. But if there are interactions, the P wave interaction, as I said, it's very weak interaction, on the order of pairwise interaction on the order of about hertz times H Planck constant. But if you have coherence time of 10 seconds, if you wait enough, long enough time, these spins will become entangled. So or quantum noise become correlated. And that's what I'm talking about. We can actually measure this kind of effect. The spin chain, and the spin is a pseudo spin path system in the electronic degrees of freedom.
So if you wait for 10 seconds, even such extremely small interactions, you feel them.
Yeah. So I'm showing you some experimental results. And you can think of this as two energy scale. One is the rotational frequency that you're rotating those spins by Rabi. They're driving you with a field. And that drive can be fairly slow because your coherence time is really long. So there's no rush for you to drive these spins really fast. In fact, when we reach 160 second coherence time, I want to make my Rabi pulse to be 160 second long. So the spin is going on very gently. Interaction, on the other hand, is on the order of hertz or so. So if my Rabi frequency is smaller than the interaction energy, what do you see? Is in fact you can think of correlated spin states in the excited state.
Is
and
this the 1D lattice of pancakes you're talking about now?
That's correct. Okay. This is talking about one particular pancake in this case. We are not talking about pancake to pancake interaction. There's no such thing at the moment. In the second half of my talk there will be. But at the moment it's just a one pancake physics. So the spins are being excited up, and you can think of the excited spin. You know, maybe this is what Leo is fundamentally really asking. There's a so-called two-photon, multi-photon transitions where you, all the atoms go into the EE states. I'm not going through. So if you have two atoms, you go from GG to GE plus EG, right? Mm-hmm. Those are one-photon transitions, and you don't know which atom took a photon.
Yeah.
But if you do two-photon transitions, then eventually GE plus EG will go to EE. Mm-hmm. And that EE state is not what I'm talking about. I'm still talking about this. So-called one-photon transition, each atom is going through one-photon transition. But even in those EG plus GE, there's a complex spin correlations because of these interactions. And if the drive has a very low frequency compared to the interactions, or compared to the splitting of the spin correlation spectrum, then you can block the transition. And this is what people have seen in so-called the Rydberg blockade physics, where as you go to longer coherence time, probe time, or lower Rydberg frequency, you can actually see instead of the line width gets broader, gets narrower as you go to longer coherence time, the line width in fact gets broader, and the transition amplitude gets blocked, gets decreasing. It's because of the interaction spectrum becomes much more complex as you wait longer. If you try to drive everything with a Rydberg frequency much greater than interaction energy. Say you drive with 1 kilohertz, you just bam with a big laser and drive them up, then you can actually resolve this so-called Fourier-limited line width, and you can drive 100% of all these atoms up to the excited state. But if you wait longer, in fact, contrary to the longer Fourier limit, shorter line width, a narrower line width, you actually get broader line width and not much excitation. This is in the Rydberg case. We can also do a similar experiment in the Ramsey spectroscopy, where now this pulse, pi over 2 pulse, can be extremely short. And when I say extremely short, meaning every spin can be rotated from pointing to the south pole to the equatorial plane, and just apply this very short pulse, quenching the system, essentially, bringing to coherence position of all the atoms into this ground excited state coherence position. And then you just wait. You just wait there. And as during this so-called dark period of time, these spins develop correlations among each other. And then you can have another pulse to come in and read out the spin correlations. And this is a classical so-called two-pulse Ramsey spectroscopy. And you can actually measure the correlation, the so-called block sphere, where initially you have this kind of red so-called individual spin noise uncertainty of the spin operators, spin half operators, and the fuzziness associated with the uncertainty of the quantum projection noise. But by waiting there, because of this correlation developing, you can actually see the classical spin noise gets twisted. And this is what people call spin squeezing and so on. And you can measure that directly in clock spectroscopy. Again, this is all in single pancake physics, and we do not resolve individual pancakes, Chris. This measurement, in some sense, is being hurt by the fact that we average over maybe 100 pancakes. So there's some Poissonian distribution of atom numbers in each pancake, resulting into the loss of signal to noise ratio. We would love to have a quantum microscope where you go in and measure 20 particles at a time. We don't have that capability at the moment. On this. So this measurement is average of 100 pancakes with a Poissonian distribution of atom numbers in there, and that's why it shows the spin squeezing number is not profound. That's because it's average over classical distributions.
Excuse me. So you measure here contrast.
Yes, contrast. Yes, that's correct.
Most things.
Yes, that's right.
Excuse me. May I ask you, in this case, what is the problem with measuring phase? If your coherence time is just really the averaging, that it is problematic.
The measuring phase just means that your laser oscillator has to be tremendously good. So you, especially if you're trying to compare one to the next measurement there's a common phase you have to reference to, and your laser phase is drifting around. You can do that with two atomic clocks. You can have your laser phase always stabilized by one atomic clock and use that to measure this. We just did that with one atomic clock.
How did you know that the atom number distribution is Poisson?
How do we know that? You can Now with high resolution imaging, we can go in there and actually measure the distribution of the numbers per pancake. And that roughly agrees with the Gaussian distribution that we have. The other thing that you can, by theory, you do a pancake by pancake, if you say 20 particles, 25 particles, what kind of a correlation you would develop. And then you average over some distribution functions over 100 pancakes, and what kind of distribution function you put it into to give you a good agreement with the experiment turns out to be Gaussian distribution.
And also if you repeat the experiment over and over,
that's right.
The total atom number is, it's distribution over atom number is square root of n as well.
Yeah, so we actually do that. We actually make the atom number by going up and down by a factor of 100, and then actually just measure the effects. And of course, when you go to larger atom numbers, the crowd gets a little bit broader, but the distribution roughly falls on the Gaussian as well.
So, and again, mostly when I talk to experimenters, they tell me they can reproduce the atom number by 5%, which is typically bigger than Schott numbers.
That's,
you say that's
that atom number, we actually, in fact, is not. Okay, so atom number fluctuation, we can completely remove it. We have the same technical atom number fluctuations, about 5%, but we can make measurements which is a quantum projection noise emitted. Why do we do that? How can we do that? It turns out it's a really very nice property of Strunzian atoms. So I have, say the total number of atoms fluctuating per shot to shot, there's a 5% fluctuation. But I'm in one particular measurement, I'm going from the ground state to the excited state. After the clock has finished this measurement, I can go in and measure how many atoms I have in the ground state by scattering photons on a very, very strong transition. That strong transition does not affect atoms that's being hidden away in the excited state. So I can do a very good atom counts, essentially have no noise, because this is a single quantum state, just count how many atoms I have. That accuracy is extremely good, so I count how many ground state atoms I have. Afterwards, I can flip the clock to move to introduce atoms hidden in the clock state, in the excited clock state, back into the ground state, and recount again. I count twice. And by counting twice, I can remove all the fluctuation of the total atom number, because in the end, what I care about is the fractional atom number difference between the two. And that fractional atom number is limited only by the quantum projection noise. It has nothing to do with technical noise, because I normalize that noise away. Is that clear? If you don't do this renormalization procedure, essentially I'm actually measuring in one single experiment, I'm measuring not only the fractional atom being excited into the excited state, I'm also giving the number of total atom numbers actually in my experiment, because I counted twice. I counted the ground state atoms, I counted the excited state atoms,
so
and it gives you the sum.
Better than the square of the atom.
In terms of the total atom number I measure, is much better than square root of n. The total atom number, in a single quantum state, there's no noise. If I tell you I have 100 atoms in the ground state, and you go ahead and measure it, there will be no square root of 100 noise limit. The 100 square root of 100 noise limit only comes from coherent superposition. When you say applied field, applied such that atoms are in a coherent superposition between ground and excited state, how many atoms are in the ground state, how many atoms are in the excited state, there you have a noise. That noise is fundamental to the so-called quantum projection noise. But if all the atoms are in the ground state, or if all the atoms are in the excited state, there is no noise, right? You can measure 100 atoms plus minus 1 or 0. So does that answer your question? So I cannot tell you if I had 100 atoms and I applied a pi over 2 pulse, I cannot tell you for sure I have 50 atoms in the ground, 50 atoms in the excited state. There will always be plus minus square root of 100 noise in there. But afterwards, if the technical noise that you were asking me about, I can go in there and measure how many atoms actually in there. So I can measure 40 atoms in the ground state, 60 atoms in the excited state. That measurement I'm absolutely confident about. So there's intrinsic quantum fluctuation. That's actually this thing is the intrinsic quantum fluctuation. But the actual measurement process itself is not contaminated by the technical fluctuation of that total atom number, because I normalize that away. Yes?
But it's probably the error bar in the vertical axis in this graph, right? because each of them is a different realization.
Yeah, so each error bar really, the up and down error bars really is actually a fundamental quantum projection noise limit. It's not, this oscillation itself is a fundamental quantum projection noise limit. And it's not technical noise. Technical noise really isn't removed from our measurements. And actually, somebody asked a question about how do we remove the clock shifts. And here is actually the trick we did. So depend on the first Ramsey pulse, you can think of the spin can be excited from ground to the excited state. In fact, in any on the block sphere, you can have a coherence of a position pointing to any of S and P's coherence of a position, right? This is about excitation angle. By choosing a particular excitation angle, and this particular excitation angle came from the balancing the interaction energy shifts in the ground state, excited state, and coherence of a position. There's different scattering lenses for GG interaction, EE interaction, GE interactions. Svarana can calculate all these scattering lenses. And it turns out that the balance of those gives rise to a particular angle of your location. You know, if you put all your spin to a certain angle, which is actually quite close to pi over 2, but not exactly pi over 2, it turns out their interaction frequency shift crosses zero. So if you operate your Ramsey clock always along this particular point, you know, always rotated, you will lose a little bit of your contrast because the best contrast is always pi over 2, pi over 2. But if you say, I'm willing to sacrifice a little bit of that contrast by doing pi over 2 minus 10 degree and then recover by the second pulse, you can actually have the interaction during the free evolution time to have a zero frequency shift. Now, this is one way to cancel the frequency shift altogether.
Can you do it with bosons?
You can do that with the bosons. You probably can, except that the energy scale is so big, the interaction is so big that you have this collective effects that may be harder to control it. But I think this effect, this particular effect is universal. In the ground state and excited state and the coherence of the position, they will all have different scattering rates. They write down those left-handed wave functions. So that as long as you're driving a particular coherent effects, coherent angles, you should be able to combine them to give rise to this cancellation. Although in this particular case, it's again the P wave interaction that's dominating. So in boson, you will be captivating the S waves.
So collective effect means that when you do it like this, then you kind of decrease interaction abruptly, and that causes some mean field.
Yeah, and in fact, this one is collective. Is you have 20 fermions. They are being excited, and they have those P wave interactions.
Right.
And those P wave interactions can result into a collective physics, because they're interacting among all of them together. And in fact, people have Anna Maria has done calculations in a pancake geometry in a two dimensional space. The P wave interaction actually has no temperature dependence. So all the even though you have a transverse mode that Leo asked that question, they're still transverse modes. Longitudinally, they're in a single ground state, but transverse, you have some thermal modes. They still have a very collective P wave interaction, an all-to-all interaction, in fact. And that made P wave interaction as if P strongly interacting fermions by P wave turns into a sort of a bosonic sort of interaction, collective excitation.
You're talking about two-dimensional.
Yeah, this is a two-dimensional pancake. Yes?
I was just going to ask, so for a three-dimensional case, would you totally be able to suppress P-wave collisions?
For
a three-dimensional case.
For a three-dimensional case, yes. So at the end of my talk, I will have one or two slides about the latest work where we have a three-dimensional band insulator. Then you have one atom per site. There will be no more contact interaction whatsoever.
Okay, with the lattice, but in the continuum?
In the continuum, I'm not sure.
Okay.
We haven't looked at that. So this work is always done in the lattice because we do not want to have Doppler effect, and we do not want to have the recoil, photon recoil effect. So the atoms are always very tightly confined in the lattice, where the confinement itself is stronger than the photon recoil momentum.
And all of it, this is done at the magic wavelength?
Yeah, this is all done at the magic wavelength so far. Chris is referring to back to where Mesrick is referring to the fact that the ground excited state has the same probability, so there's no AC star shift. And let me add a little bit of more complexity to the problem, which is SUN symmetry. So now, instead of just having atoms polarized in one particular nuclear spin state, what if now I free up the nuclear degrees of freedom? So each pancake can have a different colored balls in there. Each color represents a different nuclear spin. And what's interesting, remember that, if you remember that I said I dot J term equals to zero, to some very good approximation, to 10 to minus 4 or so of the scattering length. Then, so you can have these spectator atoms, which will interact with, say, your clock is operating on this minus 9.5 nuclear spin state. All these other nuclear spin states will be playing a role as spectator atoms. And they can collide with the nuclear spin polarized atom in a way that clearly do not have to obey Pauli exclusion principle anymore. They can have S-wave interactions. So now this clock will have both P-wave and S-wave interactions, again, within single pancake. And the SUN symmetry indicates that actually it doesn't matter how you distribute those rest of the atoms in among those different nuclear spin states. It really only the total number of atoms that matters, because each nuclear spin state is going to interact with this polarized nuclear spin state in exactly the same way. This is what SUN symmetry tells you. And experimentally, you can verify that by just varying, the, keeping the total number of atoms being the same, but varying the different distributions of the atoms. And just go all over the place of these nuclear spin states. And in fact, experimentally, you can verify the shifts. This is the same shift that I was telling you about going across zero at a particular excitation angle. And you can see whether you use different nuclear spin colors and so on, they all collapse into a single frequency shift line, indicating the nuclear spin is not important in terms of, as long as they're just playing the role of spectators.
But I thought they have S-wave interactions.
Yeah, they have S-wave interactions. But it's each one of them is interacting with it on an S-wave manner. So it doesn't matter if it's a green ball or the red ball or the blue ball. They're all interacting in the S-wave. So they can change the P-wave shift. Yeah, the P-wave shift is still limited. There's both S-wave and the P-wave contributions in there.
The P-wave one is much smaller.
Yes.
This is kind of a large.
That's right. So this slope is about the same, but the offset changes because of S wave contribution.
Mm-hmm. But it's the same for all.
Yeah. But the physics really becomes really interesting if you start to think of those are not just spectator atoms. In fact, what if you actually study a real condensed matter system. I'm not condensed matter, I'm pretending to be a condensed matter physicist. and you put them into a coherence position. Suddenly, this is not just S-wave, P-wave, but they are the quantum statistics itself will dictate the transportation of atoms if you have these pancakes, start to allow them to tunnel between these different pancakes. So now, we're going to go beyond a single site. This is what Chris has been keep asking. You know, so far, all the measurements we have been doing is single site interactions, where the spacing is lambda L over 2, L is the lattice wavelength, the so-called match wavelength. We made the lattice deep enough such that essentially we have been studying physics, two body physics in here, in each of those paintings, and we average it over. If we had a much very good spatial resolution, we could actually study individual pancakes physics in there. But what if we start to allow the tunneling to take a place. So just by lowering the lattice depth a little bit, and in fact we have a trick where we can actually keep the transverse confinement essentially the same, but we can dial down the pancake, the sort of the wall between the individual pancakes, allowing this J component, the tunneling to become important. And this tunneling at a rate J becomes interesting because suddenly you can have atoms excited in this particular wall, in this particular pancake, tunneled over to the next trapping site. And because they are excited at a different location of the laser field, clock laser has a different wavelength than the lattice laser. Suddenly this atom could come in and it look like a foreign atom compared to the atoms which were already residing in the particular wall and the particular pancakes beforehand. So you can completely change how they interact. beforehand. For example, if I had a nucleus spin polarized samples, within each pancake, only interaction that's happening in the P wave. But now if I have a particle going from this wall to this well to the next well, and this one will have a different excitation than the rest of the other atoms, and suddenly this atom can interact with the rest of the atoms through the S wave.
You mean because different pancakes has different nuclear states?
No, it's because of they all have the same nuclear spin states, for example. But because of this atom carries a laser phase from the previous site to the next site, and it's actually excitation-wise, it's 10 as a different phase. And this actually turns into a really interesting problem, so called SUN condylitis problem. So let me just give you a cartoonish slide before I give you a more detailed explanation of what's happening. So you can think of these between these pancakes, that the laser itself is this purple color, is an excitation laser. Pancakes is given by the wavelengths of the trapping laser. The wavelengths of the trapping laser and the cloth laser has different wavelengths. Therefore, these atoms, as they're being prepared in the electronic pseudo-spin power systems, they have different angles of excitation. The Rabi frequency might be the same, but there's a different mutation because of the laser phase.
How different are the wavelengths?
The difference is actually 7 pi over 6, turns out. Lambda c is actually 7 over 12. So maybe this picture will be much more clearer. So if you have the sites which is getting labeled as a 1 to n, and now I'm going to open up a synthetic dimension. So this is basically the real space, 1 to n, in along the real line of sight. If I open up another electronic spin synthetic dimension, and I have a laser that comes in, exciting these atoms, essentially making a connection between the ground and excited state. That's what the clock wave is doing, right? And each atom within each pancake is being excited by this coherent excitation of this laser at 698 nanometer. The laser that's forming the lattice is at 813. So this answers your question. The ratio is 813 over 698 in terms of the wavelength ratio. But of course, in the end, it's this guy, the spacing between those is lambda over 2. So it's really 400 nanometers, the distance between these pancakes. And this guy is coming in at 698. So that's why I said the phase shift. Each atom is being excited that has a different phase shift from neighboring sites by this phi is actually 7 pi over 6. Very close to pi, but it's not exactly pi. If you think about pi, it's kind of interesting already. If you think it's exactly pi, that means this atom excited in this pancake will have exactly pi phase shift from this atom in the next pancake. If those pancakes were independent, if there was no tunneling, nothing really mattered, because this phase is not important. That phase, for all the atoms exciting, for all these atoms sitting in the single pancake, they express one common phase shift. And that common phase shift is not important, has no physical consequence. But if you allow these atoms to tunnel between these pancakes, suddenly that does have consequence, because this atom had a different phase shift than that atom. So when this atom shows up on the other side, it's distinguishable from the rest of the other atoms. And so P wave interaction turns into S wave as well. And this becomes interesting now that I just use laser to connect between S and ground and excited state. What if I also introduce J? And that allow you to form this synthetic dimension of plaque A. Now what if we follow...
So what's J?
J is a tunneling rate.
Is it what?
A tunneling rate. You call it T maybe.
Sorry, but you already have J.
J is always tunneling rate.
So can you go back one?
So this J is... So between sites is always J.
Oh, okay.
And the vertical line is a electronic excitation by the laser. And this is the transverse between sites is a J. And if we just follow, for example, like one particular plaque, you start with ground state at site number one. You have a laser excitation with a phi. This phi is 813 nanometer divided by 698 nanometer times 2 pi. And then you tunnel from site number one to site zero, and you get de-excited by the laser. Now this time, at this site zero, there's no such phi. and then the atom tunnels back to the site one. Through this whole process, you just came back to the original state. The final state is related to this initial state by this extra phase shift thing. And this is the geometrical phase that we were talking about. This is the synthetic gauge field that we're talking about. So just by going through this clock excitation, through this tunneling, you accumulate this phase shift, this force. And that's what the synthetic magnetic field that we are talking about, spin orbital coupling. It's actually a very trivial concept in some sense that as soon as you are allowing atoms to tunnel between pancakes, and as you're exciting them from grounded to excited state, there is a, when they go through the ground state that goes forward, excited state goes backwards, there's a so-called edge currents, like a chiral currents going along. Along with it, there's a phase shift that they can think of as a synthetic magnetic field.
But there are many pancakes, and the atom can just tunnel here, then from here to here.
That's correct. So there's like many of those.
Yes, many of them.
Yeah, and in fact, you can actually study, if we have a spatial resolution, and that Chris was asking, that we will be able to actually see the currents, the ground state and the excited state current will actually have opposite directions in those pancakes.
Does it matter that you have different lengths using different?
I think it won't matter. We'll blur physics up a little bit. I think in the end, the spectroscopy I will show you now is without interactions. I just first want to introduce spin orbital coupling, kind of a single particle physics. That's what basically everybody has done. But I'm very confident about the clock experiment is because it's so clean. So now I will show you single particle physics, how this spin orbital coupling is being engineered and characterized. And we have already been able to measure all these clock shifts. That's why I took pain to explain the clock shifts per pancake, because that in the end is going to be the reference point where we are going to have introduced spin orbital coupling, and we're going to see how the frequency shift on the clock depends on spin orbital coupling. And that's the main body aspect that I want we have to pull out. But averaging over many pancakes will have the effect of maybe make the quantumness of the measurements to be a little bit classical because of averaging. So in the end, we are very interested in later on to be able to select a few pancakes. And I will show you some of also the three-dimensional experiments, 3D lattice experiments that we are doing that will allow you to remove some of those averaging problems. So the emphasis really here is I don't think I will be able to finish my talk because time is almost up. But it's that clock transition allow you to do this fantastic spectroscopy will allow you to have really allow you to study this sort of synthetic charge, synthetic fields and the charged fermions, how that move with very large spin degrees of freedom, the nuclear spin that's hidden in there. So let me just give you very quickly some of the simple physics, at least I think I should be able to finish that. That if you think of a spin orbital coupled system, if you look at the band structure, now I'm no longer talking about individual wells that Leo asked very early on. Now we are talking about actual band structures in the lattice. So because I lowered the lattice depth, so therefore you actually have a curved band instead of a flat band. And when we operate on clocks, normally we would like to have the band to be so, the lattice being so deep that there is no such curvature. But here we are talking about spin orbital coupling, so we purposely lower the depth of the lattice. And you can see that this is where the natural wavelength is. The ground state and excited state have the same curvature, right? This is what we used to deal with, and that's what I used to tell you. We can make a clock transition, and there will be no AC stock shift. But here, the picture is actually becomes more complicated. Now, see, I introduced a so-called quasi-momentum, which is an appropriate quantum number to talk about when you have band structure. When you excite an atom from ground to the excited state, if you're talking about a band structure, then the quasi-momentum actually changes. Because again, comes from the fact that there's a ratio between the lambda L, the lattice wavelength, and the clock wavelength. If this was an integer one, then this would be a no problem. But here you actually have to change this non-integer quasi-momentum as you excite it in the band structure. And again, if the band was flat, as we operate the clocks, there's no problem. The energy will still be, energy shift is what we care about, there's an energy shift. But because the band is now curved, the lattice is not very deep, then you have to take into account this quasi-momentum. And maybe it's easier to understand if I make a transformation for you. If I remove this extra delta Q, quasi-momentum kick in the excitation, by just shift the excited state dispersion curve a little bit to the point where essentially you're shifted by the ratio of the wavelength, lambda L over lambda clock. And suddenly now I can line them up in the same quasi-momentum from ground to the excited state, except now you can see there's AC star shift. Well, it's not AC star shift, it's really coming from the fact that there is this spin orbital coupling in your system. And if I remove the h bar omega, that's the clock transition frequency, if I take the Dirac's atom approach, I just remove h bar omega away, cross on top of each other in the rotating wave approximation. And you can see now two curves. This is the ground state. This is the excited state. This is where the clock excitation used to be. There's no shift where they cross. But at the zero quasi-momentum, for example, you actually see very large detuning to be able to drag it. At a minus pi quasi-momentum, for example, in fact, you see negative detuning in order to drive the clock transition, just because of the fact that this quasi-momentum spin orbital coupling is not opened up in this low lattice band, in this low lattice, low depth lattice. So if I apply, in fact, there's an interesting connection to condensed matter physics to, for example, graphene. People talk about Van Hoff singularities. This is nothing but density of states diverges near those edges. And if you look at the transitions, you will see the two ears showing up. And that's because the density of states is the largest among those where the turning points are. That's just a side note of the Van Hoff singularities. But if you drive the system with Rabi frequency omega, instead of those two band structures, the ground state and excited state, if you start to drive with omega, you're going to split this up. This is the conventional spin orbital coupling. You know, in any quantum system, two-level system, when you drive with omega, the Hamiltonian is going to be given, remember, S is a pseudo-spin half system. So you have, very classically, omega SX. This is just basically spin half being driven by a Rabi pulse, right? Omega SX. But then there's a detuning term. Delta is a laser frequency detuning from the clock transition. But now, there's this term, delta EQ, which is the band structure that's dependent on the quasi momentum, is not part of the SZ term. And so this delta EQ is nothing but actually very simply the cosine of the shift to the ground excited state dispersion curve minus unshifted dispersion spectrum of the ground state with a J, the tunneling factor in front of it. That's nothing but the uncoupled band structure. But this term now sits in front of SZ, just plays a role as if it's a detuning term. This is where the spin orbital coupling comes in. Yes, right. So the spin precession now depends on the quasi momentum. And if you want to write this as an effective magnetic field, you can think of this effective magnetic field as nothing but Bx is omega, because B dot S. So it would be Bx Sx. And this, so Bx would be omega, the Rabi frequency. Bz would be this delta, the detuning laser atom detuning, plus the quasi-momentum dependent band structure. And so these are the spin orbital coupling Hamiltonians in our clock. In some sense, very naturally arises as soon as we lower the lattice depth a little bit. This phi is lambda 7 pi over 6. That's lambda L over lambda C. This is the placate phase accumulated per placate. Yes.
So what is the temperature?
So that's actually a point I really want to make. All the spin orbital coupling work so far has been done with degenerate quantum gas. And in fact, Ian Spielman, in his review, in fact, make a point of even degenerate quantum gas is not too cold because of the interaction so weak. In here, the temperature is actually hot. It's a thermal gas. Because when I say hot, meaning the transverse modes that Leo was asking earlier, was actually thermally occupied. Even though the longitudinal modes, the pancakes are distributed like this, transverse modes are not degenerate. And so, but the transverse modes have a very weak dependence on the tunneling and so on. So they play only a secondary role. Even though there's a temperature, it's not important. We are talking about microkelvin, 5 microkelvin temperatures. Hot, you know, in some sense, more close to real material, hot atoms. And we can actually still see those spin orbital coupling effects very clearly.
Excuse me.
Can one just see this as a sub-wavelength lattice that you're making?
It's not quite sub-wavelength, but it's basically the wavelength being modulated in some sense, if you want to think of that way.
It's just like this, you shift the two.
Yeah, that's right. It's because of the spin orbital coupling. Yes, there's a, you know, Zoller had done work earlier about having atoms loaded into optical lattice, and they just, by coupling ground to excited state, open it up in the Raman coupling, you can actually have that sub-wavelength by divided by two. In some sense, you can use that language as well. It's I think it's all in this term, delta EQ. It's related, absolutely, yeah. So then you can think of as, you know, in this Planck sphere, now you can actually spin the synthetic field BQ, BZQ has a Z component, has the X component, and there's a chiral angle. So this is what people call a chiral band structure. And here we can characterize the chiral band structure by just think of characterizing this so-called chiral, non-zero chirality, the angle of theta Q, and that tells you the spin motional coupling, spin motional locking, and so on.
I was just actually asking whether all these QRs and momenta are equal.
Yeah, they are. Yes. Actually, this is a very, very good point. So if you allow me just a couple more minutes. They're all equally populated, but the clock spectroscopy allows you to select a particular slice of very small quasi momentum if you wanted. This is exactly your question. They're all equally populated, initially. But we know we can drive these transitions, for example, all from ground to the excited state with fairly large Rabi pulse. We can actually put all of them as you wish. A fraction of the population can be driven into the excited state. And you can actually measure the splitting. This is the so-called Van Hoff singularity that I was showing you, telling you about. And you can see those 2 years I was telling you, those are the density of states that was diverging. And essentially, the width of it tells you 4j, four times the tunneling constant j. So you can do very clear measurements on the ground band, what is the splitting of the j's. But even nicer trick is, for example, starting ground state, you go to the excited band. Also, excited band, also excited state. And this is what it's so, I think it's so attractive with clock. Essentially, you have at your fingertip all the tools you wanted, whether you want to manipulate internal states or external motional states, it's all very long-lived. Coherence time is just great. So you can put all of them into the excited electronic states with different color, but also excited band in the lattice. And they just remove away all these atoms. This is what I was telling you about normalization, Aita. You can actually remove away all these atoms. Now you're left with all the excited state, and you can drive them back, put them into n equals to 1, n equals to 2, whatever you want to put them. So if you put them into n equals to 1, and it's now here you can actually measure the tunneling at the first excited band instead of in the ground band. And you can see even at the same lattice depth, suddenly the tunneling rate is much, much bigger. And this is, of course, no surprise. This is actually a very nice way of measuring all of these ground band, first excited band, and so on, by all the clock spectroscopy tell you about these J's. But finally, so spectroscopy control of all these excited band population, and there's no band relaxation for macroscopic time scales that we're talking about. So finally, I answer the final question of momentum result spectroscopy. So we have all the quasi-momentum occupied initially, but you can actually do a very good resolution by selecting a small part of the atoms from the ground state to the excited state, and then just remove all the rest of the atoms. Now these atoms have a very small narrow windows of a quasi-momentum in your system, different from what you started with. And this system so this is just corresponding to doing spectroscopy at a particular laser detuning, at a particular this quasi momentum selection. And in the energy landscape, it corresponds to this, but it actually applies through different quasi momentum selections and so on. So the idea that I want to emphasize here is that you can pick one particular quasi momentum out of this distribution and use a particular detuning to go on and do Rabi oscillations. And that's what we actually were able to observe. You can actually see that by picking different quasi-momentums, essentially you have a different spin orbital coupling term. And it was a fixed detuning delta. you can have essentially realized that a different theta q, this chiral chirality angle in your system, or different synthetic magnetic field. It's all because of a different quantum momentum couples to different spin orbital coupling. The conclusion of that is that I think the clock sensitivity really opens the door for exploring this spin orbital coupled ladders, and I think in a very clean way. When we sent this paper to Nature, the referee, in fact, we're connecting by the referees, I don't know who, but sent back very, very nice comments, and in fact, they said, but so far, this is all in 1D system. Why don't you show us that whether you can do this in 3D? So I'm down today. I just want to show you that there is actually, in fact, a 3D system that's being built. We have now built basically a band insulator that one atom per side is being realized. And I don't have time to show you the results, except to highlight the very recent work that we were able to show now, coherence time of 6 seconds. Well, it is, I'm very proud of this. 6 seconds may sound very long compared to 1 second, but it is very long. And the people have never seen this kind of a coherence where you can have atoms sitting in the optical lattice and you're using lasers going back and forth. For 6 seconds, the coherence is still there. In the end, the clock should have 160 seconds, so we're still far from the end goal. But if we can start to put a system like this, the clock is already another factor of 10 better than anything I've ever demonstrated, the best clocks in the world. But I also think this kind of a three-dimensional system with spin orbital coupling opening up with a very large nuclear degeneracy, I think there's a lot of physics that can be studied by a lot of the theorists here. So with that, thank you very much for your attention. Sorry, I should have acknowledged the people who made huge contributions, but particularly I think Anna Maria Ray has been a long-term theory colleague that have been collaborating since she came to Java in 2008.
Any questions?
So there was something you mentioned but didn't really follow up on. I'm wondering if there's data that you believe that when these guys hop between the pancakes, that they're then able to interact because they have this kind of differential light shift from a differential phase from the laser?
Yes. Yes, we don't have data yet.
I wonder how you reconcile that with this lattice picture where you're drawing where this guy's hopping around a plaquette and you're treating it as a single fermion that really is the same species throughout.
Yeah, you're exactly correct. In fact, all the physics I have talked about so far has no interaction. All the spin orbital coupling. So in some sense, at the beginning, when I was talking about single pancakes, I was telling you about all these interactions and so on. And then we open up to the spin orbital coupling. But I want to do this slowly. I don't want to have lots of atoms starting to make it very complicated so we cannot understand. We actually purposely lower the atom number just so that we are kind of in the single particle regime. So we can figure out all these sort of single particle spin orbital coupling physics really clear. We are in the lab right now starting after Thanksgiving holiday. In fact, is to crank up the atom number and start to put interaction into the spin orbital coupling and see. And that we don't have data yet. But I think it's going to be really exciting because you can, you know, imagine condo lattice. You can have a ground state atom sitting in this ground band. You can excite some of them, a fraction of them into excited band, into the excited state also, and they start to move around, and they have interactions going through this spin orbital coupling. I think it will be really interesting, but I want to do it in a way that very precise so that we can rely on the fact that experimental results can't self be reproduced. You know, that's how all your quantum theorists ask us. Absolutely everything has to be reproduced based on what we understood on single particle physics with interactions, with spin orbital coupling, what's next, and that's to be coming.
Other questions?
You gave a wonderful talk. I was all the time looking at your slides in order to find the mistake.
I also found that you didn't fall asleep after all.
And I found one. Blood from MPQ Garfin is not S blood, it's Reiner blood, if it's MPQ Garfin.
Yes.
Blood. Actually, it is S plus. It's a minor blood sun. So Sebastian actually worked in the experiment as he got his PhD degree.
Okay.
I don't have the pressure of having minor blood working as a PhD.
I remember the times when he was working on his PhD.
Absolutely.
I know him since those times.
Yeah. So this comes out to be his son.
This is his son.
And okay. He has now returned to Gattaca. Well, not returned, I shouldn't say returned. He was Austrian, right?
Yes.
He was German, but then he's been Austrian, a naturalized citizen in Austria. He's now gone back to be a junior group leader in Immanuel Bloch's division.
Okay. Very good.
So that St. Julian.